Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to Family Matters. Of course, I'm Jill Ajizi, and Judge Michelle Lawrence is here. How are you, Michelle?
I'm doing great. Full day
you
of
are?
Work. I was in paternity court all day.
Oh, my. Oh, my. That's a long day, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a whole other level of parenting problems.
Whole other
you have
show.
A lot of anger and,
yeah,
you know,
because yeah.
they don't have a history of being married.
Well, I wanted to tell you really quickly, and I know you know a little bit about this, but is some exciting news in Illinois and Pennsylvania. And Illinois was really the first state. And for all the things that we don't do quite right here in Illinois, like income tax, sales tax, and politics, and everything else that we do family issues pretty well. And the Illinois legislature, specifically the Illinois House, and Representative Jill Tracy was kind enough to propose a House Resolution 0724, and it passed the Illinois House. And April is Parental Alienation Awareness Month, the first ever in the world in Illinois. So
isn't that I knew that had happened, and it's outstanding.
It
but
is.
Jill, what is that really going to mean?
Well, and that's what I was going to say. It doesn't really mean a lot to hundreds of thousands of people, but it means a lot to the alienated parents like me that finally their cause is being understood and recognized by people in power in the legislature, by doing the judges' training, which is what you're doing, that we're finally getting to the point where there's movement in this cause.
Oh, I see a lot of movement in the courts these days.
Yeah. So it's really exciting to know that. I mean, this is the Wild West, Michelle. You know that. And
right, I do.
Is we're pioneers in trying to move this forward, and I think that we are making such great strides, because when I started this 9 years ago, when my alienation started, you know, it there was nothing really going on. It was little baby steps here and there, and we are really, really doing some great things all over the country.
And it has to be said, because we always need to take the pulse on this.
Right.
And see, well, where are we? Are we getting anywhere? So it's great that you say that.
Yeah. So everybody, this is Parental Alienation Awareness Month in Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Parental Alienation Awareness Day globally is April 25th. So on that day, everybody blows bubbles at noon. Michelle, I don't care what you're doing, but you walk out on the Daily Plaza and you blow a bubble with I don't care if you do it with a wand or with just some gum, but you do it, okay?
But do I have to do it in my courtroom?
No, you could. That would be kind of interesting.
No, I know you would like that.
To do that.
Oh, I know you. You would like that.
I'm coming there if you're doing that.
Okay.
Well, let's get into the show, because we were just saying a second ago that we really have too much information for one whole show, so we're going to have to do another with this great guest tonight, and this is Dr. Mark Mosk. And I told Mark today when I talked to him, I said, do people tell you all the time that you look like Ted Danson? Because he is incredibly handsome in his headshot that he sent me, and he looks just like Ted Danson. And he said, yes, they do. So,
well, why else would we have him on?
That's right, because we like the good-looking guests. and we like some that aren't good-looking. We like all our guests, don't we, Michelle?
Yeah, and how?
Well, Dr. Mark Mosk earned his BA degree from UCLA and completed his PhD in clinical psychology at the University of Western Ontario, Canada. For all you people up in Canada listening, you've got a Canuck on tonight. So he has expertise in applied behavior analysis and attention training in the treatment of autism. He has served on the faculty of several academic institutions, including UCLA, as both a researcher and lecturer. And Dr. Mosk has lectured extensively to professional groups and has published numerous articles in professional journals and books. And he has also served as an assistant editor for several professional publications. He is licensed in both Illinois and California, which I love, because I have tons of people in California that are calling me for referrals all the time, Mark. So welcome. How are you?
I'm wonderful. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, We're glad you're here. Michelle was very excited to have you on tonight, and I was sorry to say that I didn't know about you until Michelle told me, and I think to have another resource in Illinois, in California, and nationwide is such a terrific thing, because we have such a small handful of professionals that know what we're talking about. So we're so glad to have you. Can you tell us a little bit more about your practice and why specifically we're going to be talking about parental alienation tonight? How often do you deal with it in your practice?
Let me start first by perhaps giving a very quick background. I thank you for the information that you shared already. My general background is that of a behavioral scientist. After studying at UCLA and studying primarily autism under the gentleman who was the father of autism treatment, Dr. Lovaas, I continued in that venture in graduate school, again focusing in behavioral assessment. The concept of child custody evaluations and parental and alienation were not to come to the forefront of my own mind for a good several decades later. And then after I graduated, I went back to UCLA, served on faculty there, as you mentioned previously, and then became interested in the forensic world, in part because there was appeared to be a challenge in integrating the psychological assessment and treatment world into the world of law. The opportunities to work within family law and child custody were relatively limited back then, and I'm speaking now back in the very early 80s, certainly for psychologists. I know that some of my colleagues in the psychiatry world were beginning to do some of that work, but it was in some ways very rudimentary. My entree into child custody is relatively recent, I would say, having spent most of the last 30 years doing forensics, but mainly in the area of disability, workers' compensation. But I did keep up on the family law literature and the custody literature with regard to the role played by mental health professionals. It was only in the last many years that I became increasingly intrigued once again in child custody. And frankly, it wasn't for the most part until maybe 5 or 6 years ago that the term parental alienation even came across my desk. Since that time, it has become a concept that has become increasingly intriguing, perhaps in some ways frustrating, but a concept nonetheless that is, I believe, is real and needs to be talked about extensively. I think the fact that the legislature has now recognized this phenomenon as important and in need of dissemination is a wonderful first step.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Mosk, when we first met, we met to talk about parental alienation and some other topics, but what came through to me that was so significant and why I called Jill right away and I said, we got to follow up on this, is that when you do evaluations, and for all of those listeners, whether you're lawyers or you're participants in the system or judges, you know what psychological evaluations are and how they are often ordered in custody cases and visitation cases and alienation cases. And what you talked about was that the traditional tests use, the MMPI, the Stanford, but whatever the tests are using don't necessarily measure parenting skills. So can you tell me, first of all, about the traditional tests, what they measure, and then why that's not enough?
I'm glad to. Psychological testing is a component of a child custody evaluation, as I'm sure you are both very familiar. And testing is not always done, but often is done at the behest of either the individual who requests the assessment or the evaluator himself. The process of the assessment is really one of an investigation that the psychologist is required to undertake, to investigate a variety of different sources of data to try to make determinations about parenting abilities, parenting capacity, and the competence of a parent to raise a child. When psychological testing is done, typically it incorporates a number of different tools, different instruments. Traditionally, those instruments came to us through our training, and for almost all of us who are involved in the field, it came to us in the context of our training as clinical psychologists. Certainly when I was going to school, there was no such thing as a forensic training program. There was not specific training for conducting child assessments, custody evaluations, and the like. So we brought with us the tools that we had in our bag to try to help us in the investigation process and to try to help the court to make various determinations that were being brought forward by the litigants. The issue that we first began speaking about was the issue about the transfer, as it were, of information from our conventional psychological tests to the questions at hand in terms of competency. For example, one of the most commonly administered psychological tests, not just in custody, but really in any clinical setting, is the MMPI, called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. It's been around for many, many, many decades, by far the best researched psychological tool in existence. That tool, for instance, focuses on identifying personality characteristics of the individual to whom we administer it. We can identify psychological conditions, disorders, symptomatology, et cetera. We all do that. We often do that when we are looking to try to garner empirical information, objective information about the litigants who come into our office for evaluation. One of the challenges, and I believe that this is a key challenge facing all of us in the field of family law and child custody evaluations, is that although the MMPI, for example, provides for us very useful, very rich information about an individual's symptoms and perhaps personality characteristics, at the same time, though, it does not directly tell us anything about a parent's ability to function as a parent. In other words, there is no direct correlation, there's no direct relationship between the data that we can get from a test like the MMPI and an individual's ability to effectively parent. I should say as an aside, and perhaps we'll speak about this later in the program, the notion of what is effective parenting, what is good parenting, is another concept that has yet to be adequately defined. So, yes, the conversation that we first started speaking about related to the challenge that we have as clinicians, as psychologists, in attempting in all good faith to use empirical methods to gather useful information about the parents who come to our office for evaluations.
Well,
and
let me ask you this.
Sense. Yes, ma'am.
Let's talk about, for the last 40 years, they've been doing evaluations in Cook County. They're called 604 evaluations. How have they been using the traditional tests to, for example, that you think is wrong? Because they've been doing it based upon MMPI and ability, you know, whether you have narcissism or ability to have compassion. How have they been doing it that you think is not really hitting the mark?
Well, perhaps in some ways it does hit the mark, depending on what the question is, and in other ways it certainly does not hit the mark. For example, if we would like to determine whether or not a parent actually has a serious mental disorder or some other form of psychiatric impairment that is relevant to the evaluation and certainly could be relevant to the future raising of a child, the information garnered from those kinds of tests, in fact, could be very useful. Now, not all psychological tests are, in fact, useful. There are many that are valid and reliable and good instruments. We know that the information we get from those is true and accurate. A lot of other tests end up getting administered by clinicians who may or may not be aware of the fact that the information that they are gathering, in fact, is not reliable, not valid. They're using tests that should never actually have been introduced into the child evaluation process. So if we want to answer a question, for example, of whether or not an individual is suffering from clinical depression or a severe anxiety disorder or something more profound, a psychotic disorder like schizophrenia, for example, then those tests are more than adequate and, in fact, extremely beneficial to make those determinations. However, if the question is whether or not the individual can parent effectively, the MMPI and these other tests don't provide that kind of information. What clinicians have done conventionally is that we are faced with the challenge of making an inference from the symptom data, the symptoms that an individual might present, or personality characteristics, and inferring from that how they might function as a parent. It is that bridge that we try to cross from the data provided by those tests to actually what it is that we are most interested in, which is behavior, where we are missing a crucial span of that bridge to go from point A to point B.
Mark, I want to pick up a call because I think this is relevant probably to the MMPI that we're discussing now. Is Mike? Mike, are you there? Hello, Mike? Okay. We will put him on hold and we will come back to him in just a second. Okay. Michelle, go ahead.
I was wondering whether you could cross-examine an expert on the MMPI saying, isn't it true this doesn't measure parenting skills?
I think it would be a very fair question to be asked in a cross-examination. The question ultimately becomes, how does or how did the clinician arrive at his or her conclusions regarding a parent's behavior and ability to parent in the future based upon the data that they may have drawn from some of these tests? Mind you, that the testing data, of course, as we all know, is not the only source of data that we gather in the evaluation process, but it is one that we do rely upon.
Mark, the question that Mike was going to ask, he did type into the chat room. He's having trouble getting through. So let me ask you this. He says, we have had parents steered toward paying $2,500 for an MMPI, and it was not useful to substantiating if one of the two of the parents had alienated the child. So it was a huge waste for the parent who had sought out PsycheVal to shed light on alienation of their child in a court case. How do you respond to that?
Well, I would respond by saying it depends on exactly what the question was that was asked of the clinician. If the question was asked whether or not the individual had exhibited what we might call parent alienating behaviors, I'm not aware of any literature that suggests that the MMPI can provide that kind of information. As an aside, the whole issue of what is parental alienation and how we might eventually define that term, et cetera, is perhaps a topic that we may want to chat about later in the program or in a subsequent program. But for an individual to undergo a psychological test, the purpose of that test may have had there may have been other issues that the clinician was interested in administering that particular test.
So what would the correlation be between psychological testing and parenting capacity?
Ostensibly zero. There is no direct correlation between the data that we can pull from psychological testing and parenting capacity, parenting behavior. And again, as I mentioned earlier, it is incumbent upon the clinician, therefore, to make inferences from the personality traits or the symptoms or perhaps even clinical conditions that might be revealed in a psychological test, and then apply that and create hypotheses about what the parent's behavior might or may not be. In many cases, those hypotheses can then generate other types of testing, not necessarily psychological testing, but testing a theory, for example, If the test suggests that the individual is highly agitated and that is a long-standing trait, then maybe we want to go speak to some of the collateral resources to see whether or not there is further evidence that the individual, when interacting with their children, was constantly agitated or irritable or in a hostile mood, et cetera, and perhaps that might also speak to parental alienation. But again, the results of these tests really, in some ways, do nothing more than allow us to create, as clinicians, allow us to create and generate hypotheses about what may be going on within the family dynamic, and then to go ahead and try to evaluate those various hypotheses and generate what we believe might be the most reasonable conclusion.
I want to ask you some specific things to an evaluation where parental alienation might be present. How do you determine if the children are programmed?
Programmed by one or other of the parents?
Of the parents, yeah. Or to program to tell you something about how they don't like the other parent, how the other person is bad and abusive. This is kind of what you hear. What device, what techniques do you use to determine whether they're truth-telling?
Well, unfortunately, there does not exist an empirical tool, any kind of a test that we could administer to a child, for example, that would tell us whether or not he or she is fabricating the information. Much of that has to come from the intuitive, investigative clinical interview process that we would conduct with the children, in asking them various questions about their perceptions, their views, their values, when they began experiencing these particular ideas, what happened in their lives that leads them to believe that these are the phenomena that are taking place, committed by one or the other parent. Speak to the other children as well, usually separate, one child from the other, so we can see if we can get some corroboration. And then we want to, again, look at a variety of other resources to try to determine whether or not there is consistency in the child's viewpoint. If the child's view matches exactly that of the mother, but we find, for example, that the child's viewpoint is very different from the behaviors and from the values that the child displayed prior to the onset of the separation or the marital problems in the family, then it would lead us to question whether or not the child is being completely truthful. What we ostensibly have to do as behavioral scientists is to keep driving down farther and farther in depth the line of questioning to determine whether or not the child's verbalization, the child's feelings shared with us, are those of the child genuinely, or whether or not they are shared by others, including the siblings and one of the parents.
If you ask a child, question them, and you keep doing it in different ways, can a programmed child actually hold up to exhausting them a little bit about the truth of what they're saying? Or do they eventually, because their children usually break down and their story kind of goes?
Well, you're absolutely right. First of all, it depends on the child's age and level of maturation, et cetera, et cetera. We don't want to put the child in any more of a traumatic, difficult situation by engaging them in our evaluation process than they already are going through, simply by virtue of the fact that they are an unwitting hostage, so to speak, in their parents' dissolution of their marriage. So we don't want to wear them down, perhaps as one might visualize one that an attorney might do to a witness on the stand. Yet if we, as you suggest, if we ask the same question from different angles, from different perspectives, using different terminology, across different days, different situations, and for example, in one situation where we might go to the parents' home and meet with the children there. Another case where we bring the child to the clinic and ask them those same pointed questions. It is more than possible that we may begin seeing some inconsistencies, and then of course that will drive us to ask questions even further. The children are malleable. They are afraid. They are traumatized through this entire process. And although we are all of us in the field who are who have been exposed to the to quarreling parents and the children who are involved, genuinely sense the dismay and the emotional trauma that these children are going through, may very well be unaware of the potential impact that their verbal comments might have on the long term results and outcomes of the litigation process. For example, if a child is in fact quote unquote programmed, and I'm not even sure how we would necessarily define that at this point, but if a child is heavily influenced and basically mimicking the words of one angry parent towards the other, it is more than possible that that child is unaware of the ramifications of that modeling of the angry parent's behavior.
Okay, we've got some callers. I'm going to try this one more time tonight. Caller from the 217 area code, Central Illinois. What's your name?
Robert.
Hi, Robert. How are you? It's Robert, Michelle.
I was waiting for Robert. Where have you been?
Oh, hither and thither. It's the only time I get a chance to talk to Jill.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. What's your question for Mark tonight, Robert?
Okay. We know that the MMPI provides very limited information. It has nothing to do with parent caregiving. But I know that George and Solomon came up with a battery of assessment tests to help evaluate parent caregiving. And I was wondering if you're familiar with those and if you have an opinion about them, like the caregiving helplessness questionnaire, the caregiving interview, and the parent development interview. Are you familiar with those?
I am not familiar with those specific instruments. There are, I would venture to say, hundreds of different assessment tools that are made available for custody evaluators. What you are hitting on, Robert, however, is perhaps at the key core crux of one of the challenges that we all together as professionals face in the custody evaluation arena, and that is to ultimately be able to administer an objective tool that in fact looks specifically at parenting skills and to determine what those skills are, define them carefully so we are all in agreement on what those comprehensive skills are, and then to be able to conduct systematic evaluations of those behaviors that we deem critical to parenting, and then make determinations based upon those data, those behavioral data, what needs to be done to facilitate the most effective family environment, as it were, post-divorce.
Does that answer your question, Robert?
Yeah. Do you think any of the attachment tools that they use to assess attachment analysis is of value in this situation?
Personally, I'm not, although I certainly am familiar with the attachment literature. I understand the concept is an intriguing one and probably one that exists. I am not so sure that the concept itself is useful in trying to make determinations about behavior. In other words, the idea of attachment is really a concept that we have floating in the literature now. It isn't a construct. It isn't a specific measurable methodology to determine the nature of the behavioral interactions between parent and parent and parent and child. I think it is useful to formulate ideas, perhaps, and again, hypotheses about the emotional relationships that a child may have with one parent or another. But in terms of garnering useful, objective behavioral data about the parent's ability to engage effectively with their children, I just don't see it.
I see. Thanks,
Robert. Appreciate
your
call.
Well, thank you.
All right. I'm going to grab one more, Mark. Hang on just a second. Hello. Welcome to Family Matters. What's your name?
Mike Doherty.
Hi, Mike Doherty. How are you?
We're doing good here.
Good. Do you have a question for Dr. Mosk?
Well, you stole one already, which was great, which is to address the testing aspect. But the other one is that we've run across is we've got, it does include sometimes activists, by the way, and advocate people, but definitely some custody evaluators. They're trying to pin the alienation on the targeted parent after the custody evaluator therapist, after maybe 15, 20 sessions with a targeted child who has had access, an alienated child who has had access to the targeted parent for a long time, for years, okay? And then that alienated child, in the hands of this custody evaluator, this list of horrible things that are created, terrible things this targeted parent has been doing. And with that, the custody evaluator basically says, and so do others say, okay, the targeted parent is the one who has alienated this child. Well, you know, we're hearing from other guests on this show, psychologists, who are telling us those sort of things aren't nearly bad enough to have caused a child to act, you know, off-the-scale neurotic in the fashion that PAS-affected kids act. So I guess my question is, what do we do, or is there a debate on there about, you know, what causes a child to act like a PAS-affected child? Is there a debate about the boundaries of what constitutes, you know, normal parenting errors?
It's a great question. Hello, Mike. It's good to hear from you again.
Mark.
There are a couple of issues I'd like to address. First is the notion, and you use the term PAS, parental alienation syndrome. I would probably beg to differ about the usefulness of this term as a syndrome. Of course, the PAS was initially coined back in the 1980s, as I recall, by Dr. Gardner, who was a physician and was employing the medical model to try to describe this phenomenon that we understand as parental alienation. The notion of it being a quote-unquote syndrome largely has been effectively argued against in the literature. It doesn't denigrate the fact that the phenomenon of alienation by one parent or another does exist. I think in your question, you almost answered it yourself inherently, in that if we observe the evidence of a complaint of alienation by a child and a vehement complaint, a verbalization, various descriptions of what for example, dad has done to me, and then we objectively can determine the exact nature of what behaviors did, in fact, father display. What did the father exhibit? And there appears to then be a disjoint between the intensity or the saliency, the severity of these kinds of actions relative to the horrible consequence that the child is claiming. Certainly, as clinicians, we want to be sensitive enough to recognize that there is indeed a disconnect between what is being claimed and what is most likely real. This gets back to a certain degree to the whole question of the introduction of deception, intentional or otherwise, by the parties in the dispute, whether it's children intentionally or unintentionally making claims, or parents intentionally or unintentionally making claims about their other partner's actions. So yes, it is incumbent upon us as clinicians to be sensitive and then to tease out the probability that the child's claims would match our objective data. In other words, we want to compare a verbal claim relative to what we might be able to obtain objectively, either through our clinical observations, through other resources, through records, et cetera, et cetera. If there isn't correspondence between the two, then we certainly want to be asking the question of whether or not the child's claim is in fact genuine. And even though there may be, for example, some alienation, maybe that phenomenon, the practice of those alienating behaviors, is not nearly as significant as the child is is describing, or in fact, the child may simply be misperceiving some of the parents' behaviors.
Great,
Tim.
Mike?
Does that answer the question for you? Because I'd like to follow up with how do you determine? And I have this question, this problem as a judge, whether there's actual physical abuse in many of these kind of cases. The alienating parent comes in alleging physical abuse. Many judges then say, well, we're going to supervise the visits. They just don't know. And when you're the evaluator, how do you go about doing that?
Wonderful question as well. And you're hitting all the key points and perhaps some of the chinks in the armor of our current methodologies and tools and procedures available to us in the mental health field to try to address some of these questions. There are certainly a number of clinicians and researchers who have published articles on the assessment process behind identifying the possible presence of violence in the family. As I recall, there was a relatively recent article published that had indicated that, in fact, much to my surprise, that was about 50% of the allegations of domestic violence in families engaged in custody disputes, about 50% of those allegations were found to be upheld, which frankly was shocking. Once again, if there is an allegation of abuse, we want to, as clinicians, in a highly systematic and structured fashion, identify the exact components and elements of that alleged abuse, when it began, for example, how did it manifest, what was done at the time, was anybody told, are there court records, are there police records, are there corroborative reports, and one of the challenges is the fact that even though we have children, perhaps, who are involved that could serve as parties of information or sources of information, we can't necessarily rely upon the integrity of those self-reports of the kids. So instead, what we're faced with is a process of instead step by step trying to carefully delineate and define what it is that the alleging parent means by domestic violence, and as we spoke about before, to determine whether or not this is potentially a fallacy. Is it just a reflection of the individual's anger? Is it a false allegation? Or is it an allegation that contains the full truth, or is it an allegation perhaps that contains partial truth? Unfortunately, I would characterize them as high quality, reliable instruments that we could readily administer to a parent that would indicate to us, yes, absolutely, this is a violent individual who has committed violence within the family. It's a sure thing. And so instead, we are left with using some of our clinical skills and, again, a systematic investigation process of inquiry.
Just out of curiosity, how reliable are lie detector tests?
Oh, boy, that is a can of worms you just opened, Michelle.
I know, but I can't help it. You know, we're desperate here on the bench. Sometimes you just don't know, and sometimes I ask the parties whether they do that just to see if they both say yes.
Okay. I'll try to be brief.
Boy, hang on just a second, Mark. I'm having a really hard time hearing you right now. I don't know what just happened, but are you still on the? You're still on the same phone, right?
I am, and I'm hearing all of you perfectly.
Huh?
Yeah, me
okay.
too.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh no, did you get the question that I asked him? Or did you
miss
that?
I heard your question. It's just there's a lot of static for some reason, and maybe it's just me hearing it. I hope that's the case. Go ahead. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, well, we're talking about lie detection. The concept of lie detection or deception detection goes back a very long way, and I'll be brief here because we certainly could spend an entire, not just 1 hour, but several hours talking about the whole notion of deception in the courtroom. There are several different schools that have attempted to try to to study and understand whether or not an individual is telling a lie or is in some way fabricating information. There is what we conventionally as a society understand as a lie detector using a physiological information. And actually, as I'm speaking now, I'm blanking on the exact term that for which people are instructed by the court to go for lie detection to determine whether or not they're lying. There's a school of researchers that have looked at physiological measures, the degree to which an individual is nervous in responding to questions, breathing rates, and those kinds of measures. There's another school of individuals who look at the verbal behavior, looking at the content of what people say, the use of certain kinds of pronouns, the certain elements of grammar that may be indicative of deception. And then there's a third arena of individuals who have been studying the actual components, the auditory, the audio components of the voice. And those are called, and that is related to voice analysis. Within that arena, there is a subgroup of types of tests that are psychologically based. And so these are certain kinds of psychological tests that within them inherently are built certain scales, certain indices that can measure whether or not an individual might be exaggerating or might be withholding information. So since I don't hold expertise in any but one of those arenas, let me at least address the issues in psychological testing. Let me go back to the MMPI because it's a instrument that we've already been discussing, and it's one that many people are familiar with. The MMPI, for example, has multiple scales built into the 500-plus questionnaire that can tell us, after being scored, whether or not an individual is exaggerating the symptoms that they're presenting, whether or not they are withholding information and being what we call defensive and avoiding disclosing information, and other scales that will then inform us whether or not both phenomena may be taking place. I believe that it is inherent in the forensic world where an individual raises his or her psychological status in the course of litigation that there is a propensity for an individual to modify or potentially misrepresent the truth. Within, for example, in the world of disability evaluations, what we tend to find, and not surprisingly, is that individuals will exaggerate their symptoms because they're interested perhaps in a bigger cash outlay should they win their case. In the world of custody, it is completely the opposite. What we find instead is that custody litigants, generally speaking, have a more of an inclination to withhold information, to not disclose various symptoms that they may or may not have, because they want to put their best foot forward. They want to look as good as possible to the evaluator to, in their mind, increase the likelihood that they might be seen as the quote-unquote better parent or as a fit, quote-unquote fit parent. And it is our job, therefore, to take that information and to take it into consideration as we evaluate the data from that test, but also as we evaluate the information that they share with us across the desk within the clinical interview.
Mark, how do you think we got to this point in family court with custody evaluations where we are today?
Oh, boy, that is also an excellent question. To give a relatively brief answer, if one looks back historically, we find that the introduction of the mental health experts into the courtroom in family and domestic relations matters really began certainly within, I would say, the last 40 to 50 years, largely at the onset by psychiatry. And of course, psychiatrists brought with them their training backgrounds, as well they should, which is based on the medical model. And in the medical model or the biomedical model, what we have are the notions of a symptom-based disorders, individuals who have various kinds of symptoms that may or may not require treatment. They develop syndromes, going back to Mike Daugherty's commentary about the about PAS. And they brought with them a framework that looks at child custody from a medical model. That medical model is not necessarily in concert with what I might otherwise describe as a behavioral model or a psychosocial model, wherein, for example, in my training background of behavioral analysis, behavioral assessment, what we are most interested in is looking at specific behaviors, operationally defining what those behaviors are, systematically assessing the presence and frequency of those behaviors, and then making recommendations about those behaviors. As a result, what we have in the courtroom now and in the custody evaluation process is what I perhaps might view as a residual or a remnant of what the medical model, the biomedical model, brought into the world of custody. We have, for the longest time, we had, for example, the Rorschach psychological test that was a mainstay of psychoanalysis. And the Rorschach, although I'll probably make enemies when I say this, the Rorschach has, to a large degree, really been defunct as a valid, useful tool in the forensic setting. And
really?
There's substantial clinical literature that support this. And for the most part, the Rorschach really isn't recommended for use in the forensic world, and to a large degree, not even in the clinical world anymore. Again, a topic for perhaps another lengthy discussion. The challenge, I believe, though, is that also within the medical model, we talk about concepts. We talk about concepts, for example, of attachment. We talk about a clinical model. And what we have found over time is that applying the clinical model, where there's a lot of clinical intuition and subjectivity and gut instinct, hopefully using a lot of clinical experience, but still subjective information nevertheless. What we have slowly, gradually been transitioning to, and the field is slowly moving in this direction, to replace the clinical model, as it were, with a forensic model, with an empirically based, scientifically bound approach to asking the questions about parenting capacity and the like. The very first commentary that you made when we first got started on the program about being in the Wild West and being pioneers, you couldn't have stated it any better, because that is very much where we still are. We are moving west. I think we're to some degree a little bit west of the Mississippi, but we're far away from the West Coast.
Well, you're also a little prejudiced, aren't you? Wouldn't you?
Well, just a tad. Although as a former Californian and now a proud Illinoisan, I don't know if that's the right term. I am blessed to be living here now.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, though, I think this is part of our history that we have been working within this medical model, and as a result, perhaps to some degree, we are now living with terms that have become problematic. For example, the concept of parental alienation. We all have a feeling for what this represents, concept is.
I think, Mark, it's one of two things. I mean, either it's that people don't understand the term, or they have a very negative concept about what it is. I mean, it's a very negative thing, but they think it's automatically something that they don't need to deal with if it's in the courtroom setting, because those words set off really a negative undertone.
Well, I would respond by saying that I'm not – although I have read many, many dozens and dozens of articles and attended conferences on parental alienation, I am still not sure, as a 30-year veteran in the field now, of exactly what we mean by parental alienation as an accepted construct within the world of child custody. Is it the child who's being alienated? Is the child engaging in alienating behaviors to a target parent? Is it the parent's actions that are creating alienation? What does alienation mean? Does it mean that that the perpetrating parent is specifically trying to drive an emotional wedge or a physical wedge between a child and the target parent? If so, how does that manifest? Is it done consistently? Is it long-lasting? What is the ultimate impact functionally, emotionally, behaviorally on the child, short-term and long-term?
You're just throwing these questions out hypothetically, right? Because I'm hoping that you know the right answers to these questions.
I wish I did, because frankly, there isn't an answer yet. We are all to some degree struggling with trying to identify exactly what this phenomenon is, and it's important. It's critical to understand what this phenomenon is, because certainly we see elements of this fracturing of a family unit taking place in disputing families, and children becoming less appearing to become less involved and less emotionally affectionate toward one parent or another. But we still don't know exactly what we mean by alienation. For example, this issue was and perhaps still is being addressed by the multiple committees that are attempting to finalize the new version of the DSM, the DSM-5.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't.
Right.
The concept of introducing a syndrome, I believe it was going to be classified as a syndrome or perhaps disorder, parental alienation disorder, was raised in those committees, I'm going to venture to say some couple years ago now, and has been bandied about for a long time. It is my understanding that due to primarily the fact that it is not well operationally defined, that it is not going to be included in this next iteration of the DSM. So, unfortunately, I don't have an answer to
I just want to give a little input on this. As to the question that you're talking about in the evaluation of the DSM-5 and who's actually got the disorder is one of the problems. So, but I would put a slash, and then I would say, but there are a lot of experts who have done a lot of work to say, this is the symptoms, these are the consequences, these are the 17 or however many, depending upon the researcher or expert, symptoms of the alienating parent. These are, and they've gone very far to be very specific about symptomology in the alienated child. And it really holds up in the most extraordinary ways. When you see a case and it has alienating behaviors, you are going to see almost all the ones on the list. So I think there's a lot of sophistication, not necessarily taught in the schools.
Absolutely.
But
if you look at somebody like Dr. Craig Childress out of Pasadena, California, a friend and somebody who's really developing an interesting protocol in this field and really kind of come on the parental alienation scene very strongly of late, his whole take on it is that we don't need to be so concerned with getting this into the DSM-5 because the real problem here is the alienator. And their diagnosis, there's a million of them in the DSM-5 that cover the problem. So in treating, in trying to get an alienator into therapy with the target parent and the child is what he's working toward. He's saying stop spinning your wheels on trying to get this into the DSM-5 and let's concentrate on trying to get people like you and other mental health professionals to understand that, yes, this does happen to children. And I'm here to tell you, there's parents, Mike Doherty and other people that are listening tonight that will tell you that they have children who are dramatically affected by this, and me being one of them, four children that I had wonderful relationship with that turned on, in 4 weeks and 6 days on me and my entire family for the last 9 years, and all of these people can say the same thing. In every case that I deal with, it's the same set of circumstances with a few different nuances, but it's very, very specific. And if mental health professionals don't know the answers to those questions you just threw out. That's one of the huge problems.
I am in complete agreement with everything both of you said and Dr. Childress' point as well. The point that I was intending to make was that there is yet to have been reached an agreement within the mental health field of exactly what are the components of a parental alienation that we should be evaluating within our assessments. There are, you're absolutely right, numerous brilliant experts and researchers who have valiantly attempted and continue to work in the area to elucidate the specific components of what this phenomenon of alienation is. But as of yet, as of today, there's still is no broad agreement of exactly what alienating behaviors are, so that from case to case to case, we can consistently present information to the court to say, yes, there is evidence of alienation, no, there is not evidence of alienation.
But I guess what I'm saying is, if this is going to continue to escalate like it is, I mean, globally it's a pandemic. In the United States and in Illinois, I mean, it is a hotbed of parental alienation. I'm hoping that that's going to change because of the work that Michelle is doing, because of what we're trying to do here in Illinois and training family court judges and use this state as a guinea pig to tell the rest of the states how to behave in family court. But if it's going to continue to escalate and you're going to see more cases in your practice, don't you eventually get to the point where you have a model that you can work from and say, oh my goodness, this is the same set of facts I saw yesterday. This must be something I need to move forward and try to develop some sort of protocol to treat these children or to make the assessment I need to make.
Yes, you are absolutely right, and I believe it's incumbent upon every mental health professional who does this kind of work to develop a protocol that they can administer consistently over time to different families, so that they consistently are speaking about the same phenomenon when they submit reports. One of the and I should say, as to interject as an aside, I think that Illinois, rightly so, would be in a great position to develop a research center that focuses specifically on the development of a tried and true, reliable methodology that could to assess alienation that could then be imparted and trained across the nation. One of the difficulties, the challenges that we have is, yes, I very well, although I have seen alienation in my practice, most certainly, and I very well can, and perhaps over time we'll be able to create a far better, more comprehensive checklist of what I would deem as alienating behaviors, it doesn't mean necessarily that my checklist is the same as Dr. Smith, who's in the suite next to me, who also sees custody evaluations. So he and I may very much, although we both may have our own protocols, we may be representing to the court the presence or absence of alienation using two different sets of protocols. What is needed ultimately is a standardized protocol, standardized set of comprehensive variables that we can, as mental health professionals, look at and as legal experts look at and help us to determine whether or not there is or is not alienation and the degree to which there is alienation taking place.
Good, Dr. Moss. Put that on your to-do list.
Yeah. Let's do it.
I would really appreciate that. And I know what you're saying, and I think that the way you phrased it shows, you know, what a lot of mental health professionals view, and this is when I talk about it to people, is why I say let's be careful we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And that it makes it a lot harder that there's no protocol, but there's nothing easy about this whole thing, and it's very, very, you have to go really, really deep, and you don't have those guideposts all the time, although it's getting closer all the time. And for me, the information that is out there gives me a lot of ability to see things from my position, but I'm not as exacting as a clinician who needs a diagnosis. So I know what you're saying.
Well, just as we said at the beginning of the show, we are now out of time, and we're going to have to do a second show with you, Mark. So I will get with you tomorrow, and we can set up another time for you to come back, and let's finish this discussion or move on to some other things that we can cover. We really appreciate you being here tonight, and I'd like to invite you, if you'd be willing to come on June 30th, Dr. Amy Baker, who is an expert in PAS and parental alienation, and attorney Brian Ludmer will be speaking in Chicago on June 30th for us at Children's Rights Council and Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, and we'd love to have you be our guest there just to hear some interesting information that they have to disseminate.
I would be honored to join you.
Terrific. Oh, great. Jill, do you know any more information about where people could get their tickets?
Yes, they can register at crc.illinois. Oh, my gosh. It's Children's Rights Council Illinois. My gosh, Mike, if you were still on here, and I'm hoping you are.
Well,
we'll
announce it next time,
yeah,
too.
Children's Rights Council Illinois website is where you can. It's crckidsillinois.org. Thank you, Mike, for putting that in the chat room for me. And so register there. It's $40, very reasonable to hear two experts. And Mark will be there. You can talk to him, and we'll have him on the show again. Thank you all so much for being here. We learned a lot tonight, and we appreciate your time, Mark.
Thank you, everybody.
My pleasure.
And we'll talk to you all in 2 weeks. Thank you, Dr. Mosk. Really appreciate it. And I'll see you when you give your seminar, I think in May.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye, Michelle. Okay. Hello? Hello?
I'm still here.
Are you there? Okay, hi. Thank you so
hi.
Much, Mark. I just wanted to tell you thanks again, and it was really great. And I didn't mean to – sometimes I get a little emotional about the whole, you know, questions and answers that talk about it maybe not really happening. And I know people were in the chat room going, what's he saying? Why is he saying that? So I get a little emotional sometimes.
No, and absolutely, and I hope I didn't misrepresent what it is that I was intending to speak, intending to convey, which was simply the fact that we need to do a better job as a community
right.
to define what this is, so we can pick it up quickly.
You're absolutely
right. If we can, you know, intervene as early as possible, but certainly even if we don't intervene, to determine whether or not this is an element that needs to be taken into consideration by the court.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we will. I'll look at the schedule and email you tomorrow. Does that sound good?
Wonderful.
Thank you so much, and you have a great night.
Okay. You too. Okay.
All right.
Bye, Michelle.
Bye. Hello.